All right, what is going on, everybody? Welcome back to another Serious Angler podcast powered by our friends over at X2 Power Batteries. Back again with the captain, Mr. Andy Full, and as always, I'm your host, Bailey Egbert. Andy, what's going on, man?
You know, just another Tuesday. I almost said just another Monday, but it's actually Tuesday, so Tuesday Night Live. You know, just getting ready. I think I'm going to be on the water for like 12 of the next 14 days after today, so it's going to be a pretty busy stretch here. Going to be hopping back and forth from smallmouth to largemouth and back to smallmouth. So got a lot of driving. I was supposed to get an oil change today, but I got too busy doing a bunch of other things, so that didn't happen. So I got to figure out when I'm going to do that as well in the next like 4 days before my truck decides to blow up again. So we'll see.
Again,
don't buy a Ford, especially a 2020 Ford F-150. The transmission will die before 40,000 miles.
Or just don't buy Ford.
Or just don't buy Ford, yes. What's up with you, buddy? How was your weekend?
It's been fun.
Starting to feel better.
I felt fine. That was actually the shocking part. I had my bachelor party this past weekend for you guys that are listening or are watching this right now. So that is why Andy is teasing me. But yeah, I had the old bachelor party up in the Adirondacks. And it was good. Had all the boys up there. Obviously missing old Capitan, unfortunately.
Yeah, sorry I couldn't be there.
Hey, you had a much more important thing to tend to at home.
Yeah,
AKA wedding anniversary.
It was a fun weekend, let me tell you.
Oh boy, don't say that too loud. Somebody might clip that and send it to you.
No. Like, hanging out with the family was great. Just things that we had planned we couldn't do because of other things. So it just essentially being like a honey-do list weekend. Installed a security system on my house, among other things. So made Amanda happy, but yeah, like the big plans that we planned fell through, so we're going to try to do some of the stuff Friday, and I think we're going to Rochester for a concert, so that'll be fun.
Ooh, who are you going to see?
Donna and the Buffalo. They're like a
what?
Indie rock band that Amanda loves. Donna the Buffalo, I think it's called, and they're
in the world?
Yeah, but so that's what we're doing Friday night. If that's what Amanda wants to do, we'll do it. So
nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
I am back on the work grind back here at home. I got a work trip this week going to Wisconsin from tomorrow until Friday. I'm supposed to, fingers crossed, where is any piece of wood I can knock on that I have the flight intended home that I'm supposed to and get home around.
Jeez, traveling is so bad right now.
My brother's back from Utah and he flew in. He had his flight canceled twice trying to fly home. So he stayed an extra day and a half, basically.
Is he still at your house?
No, he flew home this morning. I had to drive him to the airport at 3:30 this morning.
Brutal.
Yeah, it was not a lot of fun. But he got home okay. But yeah, I'm hoping that my flight, everything is smooth because I have a derb this weekend. The last regular season NYKBF event, New York Kayak Bass Fishing event, or local trail here, up on Lake Ontario / St. Lawrence River. So I'm going in no practice, just kind of going off of history. As of right now, another knock on wood that hopefully the wind will allow me to get on the lake. As of right now, so far so good, but we'll see. Might be interesting.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, you never know. It's changing every 10 hours.
It's been changing. I had plans for a guide trip this weekend, which right now it looks like it's going to happen. But yesterday it was basically canceled. And then this morning I was like, wait, the wind changed. It looks good. Like, we're good. And now, I look again tonight and I'm like, ooh.
Thankfully where I'll be at, I can handle south winds, north winds. It's basically I just can't have straight west. And that's as of Friday, it looks like straight west, but it at least dies as of right now around dinner time, like dead until morning. So hopefully that's the case. So we'll see. We'll see what's going to happen. I'm excited to go chase some big old smallmouth and big old brownfin tunas, hopefully. But I'm more excited, Andy, for our show tonight. Mr. Stephen Barden, who are we working through some technical difficulties, but we're going to make it work. We're going to make it work one way or another. So without further ado, let's see if we can get this baby to work here. Mr. Stephen Barden, you got us?
I got you if you got me.
Yeah, we had to mute the one that we could see you. But we have the one that can hear you, and we have – so we're good. I think we're good.
Yes.
Yeah. As long as it works, who cares? And at least I'm not making stuff up like band names and stuff like Andy's doing.
Yeah, it definitely sounded made up.
No, it is definitely not made up. Hold on.
Are you actually
looking? The band is Donna the Buffalo, and they are out at Ithaca, New York, I do believe. And they play like – it's like indie folk rock type stuff. They're kind of fun. So Donna catchy songs.
Buffalo.
Does Donna
she,
the does Buffalo.
She look like a buffalo? Is that why they're called?
Yeah, I don't know why they called their Donna the Buffalo, but if there's anyone in Rochester who knows that band or from New York, they're actually not bad. See, here we go. Henrik Kellogg here, amazing band. I'm not the only one who knows Donna the Buffalo. So I honestly would have never known about Donna the Buffalo if it wasn't for my wife and her family. And they're enjoyable to listen to. So
it's a respectful way to describe it, Andy.
Yeah,
enjoyable.
But I mean, you should
with heavy alcohol intake.
At this point, you should know all my answers. My answers are enjoyable and it's okay. So like, it's okay. Like,
Steve, Andy answers every show with, "Oh, you know, just another day."
That's how it is, just another day.
Then he says, "Just another day," and then it turns into something catastrophic, something horribly wrong.
Just another day.
His "just another day" is like your worst day ever, Bailey.
Yeah, I think so.
It could be.
Oh man. Well, dude, Steve, what you been up to, man? It's been a minute since we had you on the show, and you've been running around rampant. Seems like you've been all over the map. But what's been, you know, the main thing for you recently?
Well, we completed the MLF season on the Bass Pro Tour. So that's a little bit of a workload off my back. Also, we did several habitat projects, some really cool stuff. KBD even went back and fished one of our habitat projects from last year, and that turned out to be a really cool adventure. And on the private lake side, we completed stocking season, survey season, and now we're in that summer grind where we're building a lot of new lakes, not a lot of new private lakes. And we're also doing quite a bit of vegetation control and then some habitat work. So it's all outside. It's all hot. You know, it's dry here in Texas. Literally every phone call starts with somebody complaining about the drought or the heat. And then we joke about that for like 2 or 3 minutes and then we're on to it again.
Is there any more of the Major League Fishing restoration projects this year, or so are they all done?
We're all done for what we have scheduled. Typically we will do one in the off season during the team series filming events, but I've got some conflicting conferences on my schedule. We're doing a Friends of Reservoirs conference during one of the team series events, so I've got to try to make it work, but I may just push to do 4 or 5 next spring instead. It's just my schedule's not going to work out to let me do everything I want to do.
All right.
You guys know who that is.
Yeah. You're like, hey, I might have 10 minutes next Wednesday to say hi to you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
10 minutes turns into 30 seconds and then nothing. So
that's exactly right.
Yeah. Well, Steve, we already have some questions rolling in.
Okay, great. Yeah,
we'll start rolling into some. We have our pal here, Mr. Anthony Geis, who's asking which one here has more impact on bass, and that is it either the moon phase or the major minor? I think he's meaning the barometric pressure. Which one has more effect on how the bass behave?
Seasonally, moon phase, but on a day-to-day basis, barometric pressure. Okay. So if we're just talking about how do we catch more fish, moon phase is going to, and it's really photo period, right? How much sunlight / moonlight is available to those fish to feed at night, compared to every single day you're going to have barometric pressure changes, and those changes will affect it hour by hour.
It's like a long-term versus short-term type of deal.
Exactly. Yep. Okay. You need both.
Makes sense.
understand both.
Yeah, we have another question from Scott. I'm sure you've been seeing it. You're going through it, obviously, being in Texas, this crazy, crazy heat. I've been seeing some people are having some records in heat, like our buddy Alex Rudd over in Tennessee has been talking about they're hitting records almost weekly for heat over in Tennessee. But curious how he's asking how these storms and the heat that we're going through right now are affecting these fish.
That's a great question, Scott. And one that we could really dive into. I mean, we could spend half a show on just temperature and the gradients and what it does. You know, in the environments where your bass are used to heat, what you end up with is you have a thermocline. And a thermocline, at some point during the summer, becomes so dramatic that you're below the thermocline, you also create an oxycline. And an oxycline would be a change in oxygen. You know, so you have a change in temperature, that's what thermocline is, and you have the oxycline that would build up over time. And at some point, underneath the thermocline, which will end up with zero oxygen. And so as the summer heat drags on, that thermocline gets shallower and shallower, and that area with no oxygen becomes larger. So your fish generally are going to try to spend as much time in the coolest water they can find that still has some oxygen, which in most reservoirs means they're going to sit on or below that thermocline this time of year. And in the reservoirs where they don't have a lot of experience with that, because they're not, you know, typically used to summer heat, you may have some fish that become very stressed. Those fish will typically move shallow, you know, overnight, trying to, you know, find cooler water, and sometimes get trapped in pockets or coves, and you may even have like a low dissolved oxygen kill in certain areas that will kill some fish off. You know, it is a time when fish feed a little less often. You know, all fish are, you know, basically not able to regulate their body temperature. So their body temperature is very closely associated with water temperature. To an extent, that means that as warmer temperatures increase, their metabolism speeds up and they need to eat more often. And then at some point, it becomes, you know, a little bit of them trying to just survive causes them to become more lethargic, more stressed. So then they quit eating. You can also have things like, because of water temperature being so great, metabolism being so quick, you can have some poor water quality affecting, you know, their skin, even their slime coats. You can see some reddening on those fish, especially around the gills and on the chest. That's just from poor water quality, things like ammonia building up in the water as water quality deteriorates with temperature. You also have water's ability to hold oxygen decreases as temperature increases. Mm. So, you know, during the spring, you may hold like 8 parts per million oxygen. But as water temperatures increase, that number is going to go down and it'll start 4.5, 5 parts per million oxygen, and that becomes a little bit dangerous. Anything below 4 is very stressful and can start causing some fish kills. So the temperature is not a great thing. There are fish species that are more apt to handle low dissolved oxygen and high temperatures. There's also, even within, you know, like our largemouth community, there are fish genetic lineages that are more adapt to those environments. And then, of course, the more repetition that you have throughout your life of these events, the more you're, you know, hardy you are to them. So the fish up north that maybe aren't used to these warm temperatures, they're going to become more stressed than the southern fish.
It definitely makes more sense for our summer fish, Andy, up north, like when those temperatures get crazy, like there's, we have those stretches that are 90 degrees and become super hard to catch them. That, I guess, that would make sense then, Steve. That's exactly what's going on.
Yeah, those fish, you know, not necessarily are going to move more offshore. They're just going to move more vertically in that water column. And at some point, they're going to hover right at that thermocline. And you can even see it a lot of times on your 2D. You can picture that thermocline, because what you're seeing is where plankton will build up And you know, the density of water is so great below the thermocline that the plankton can't sink below that. And so you see a lot of plankton build up, and you'll see that in your 2D. A lot of your fish will just, they'll hover at that. They'll go to that thermal refuge where the water's a little cooler, but maybe the oxygen's not safe, so they can only stay there so long. And so they'll just be up and down right there.
That's pretty
good. Survival mode, though. That's survival.
Yeah. Yeah. So we had Keith Carson on the show last week, and I promised him I would ask this question because he was curious of it too. He was talking about when you're hooking specifically smallmouth, and there's sometimes when you bring smallmouth up and you have them like perfectly, you know, hooked in the lip, nothing damaging, clean, you know, clean catch. They use a net and all that jazz, and they still start bleeding out of nowhere. Some people say that it's you brought them up too fast or something or the other. It's a stress thing. What do you think that causes for them just to bleed out of nowhere?
Yeah, I've never seen it personally, but I would imagine that has to be a stress-induced response. You know, the gill is such a sensitive area anyways. The gill filament, I'm sure we talked about it before, but the gill filament is a blood supply, right? It is a blood supply that runs the opposite direction. So it runs from the back of the fish forward so that whenever water comes past the gill, it can grab the oxygen and release things like ammonia out of the gill. But it's very sensitive membrane. And as those fish come from deeper water, especially, that's a pressure change. And those pressure changes, they can cause some weird things. You know, they cause the swim bladder to inflate. Of course, we know that with barotrauma or, you know, needing to fizz a fish. We see that.
Right.
But yeah, I would imagine that would play some sort of role, that stress of bringing the fish up.
Yeah, I understood what you're saying. I know, Andy, you've seen it too. It's a interesting deal. Like, it's everything's perfect. You bring them up, you're like, I didn't do anything wrong. Like, why are you bleeding? It just drives you nuts.
Well, and a lot of times it's not even the gills. It's where the hook penetrates the fish. And then right where the hook penetrates them, depending on where it is in the mouth, you'll see the blood like just dripping out of it. I always thought it was just a pressure deal because the only time you ever really see it on like the smallmouth here in Buffalo is when you catch them in like 25 feet or greater. Doesn't matter the time of year, they all bleed, but like some are worse than others. And I think it depends on how fast they race to the surface and jump and the pressure change and whatever other variable there could be.
That makes a lot of sense, Andy. And you know, when you get to survival mode, you know, just all animals there, survival mode means they're going to push blood to their external parts, right? Like they're going to be recover from that hook penetration. Does that make sense?
You're a popular man. Is that what's making the phone thing bounce off? Are you just getting like texts or calls?
I'm telling you guys, constantly.
You're
constantly
famous
this time of year. No, it's you know, anytime you are in Texas and it's a drought and it's the middle of summer, things happen in ponds. You know, you'll have turnovers, you'll have fish kills, you'll have vegetation. What, you know, vegetation can only grow in a certain zone that we call the littoral zone of your lake. That's where sunlight can penetrate. But during a drought, like your whole lake becomes the littoral zone. You know, you talk 7 or 8 feet of loss. So yeah, I get a lot of phone calls this time of night. And people come home from work and they've got a question.
It's just people freaking out because their pond is looking weird or something like that. Is that what that is?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of times, you know, it's just when you finally see something, when you finally pay attention to it, that's when it's most important. You know, so
unfortunately. You know,
unfortunately,
I'm trying to find a picture of a smallmouth that was bleeding and it was a perfectly hooked fish in like the front of the face. I found one, but hold on, let me go back to it. But you can just see, I don't know if you can see it really well, but you can see how the blood is just like raining down the side of the fish,
right? It's that not fish, a lot of blood.
Oh, it's quite a bit. Like, you wouldn't see it in the photo, but it literally was like all over. It's kind of a poor example because of the thing, but you could see how it's like coming down from its gills and stripping off of its tail. That fish was hooked perfectly in the roof of the mouth and the front lip, and they had no gill issue, but it was literally just like pumping blood out of that hole.
Amazing. And so you release that fish, or are you going to try to, what is your go-to method?
At that point is, it is just get a picture of it and try to get it back in the water as fast as possible. So it can relieve the pressure. But like, I feel like this time of year, if you don't catch one that bleeds like that, it's like an anomaly pretty much on my end, especially over 40 foot of water. Like, it just happens.
Yeah. It's very interesting. Yeah. Well, you know, if you catch a bleeding fish and you put it back in the water, it's kind of designed to where the water stops the bleeding, you know, so that's probably a very temporary issue. And of course, the faster you get that fish back in the water, it will typically go back down, and stop the pressurization issue. If you hold that fish above water for 4 or 5 minutes, that's when you start seeing barotrauma and things like that.
Yeah, and that's the thing I'll do, like, instantly if I see that they're bleeding real bad, especially with clients, I try to get them in the net just to get them in the water to relax them before we take the picture to try to slow it down. And then if we do hold them out of the water, I always carry 2 or 3 fizz needles in my boat so I can take care of the barotrauma to get them down, because the fish's health is the most important thing. So, I mean, there's been days where I'm out fishing around other boats and I've had to scoop fish up and fizz them because they had to take 7,000 pictures of it. And I'm like, all right, this one's going in my live well for a little bit so I can resuscitate it. And we can usually get them back to Dr. life.
Andy is back in town. He's taken like, care of.
Yeah.
Clear! CPR!
All right. Yeah.
When clients are fishing and I'm like in the live well fizzing fish, holding them upright, trying to get them back to normal, and then once they get that color back and enough strength, they go right back in the lake.
And you use a side fizz?
Yeah, I'm all about the side fizz. And that's another note that I would like to like make note of is I've watched some other people fizz fish here recently, and they tend to go too low and they'll hit fish in the stomach. Mm-hmm. I think, and you can tell me if I'm wrong here, when it comes to fizzing them, I almost feel like if you're going to miss the air bladder, you'd want to miss high. Right, because then you're hitting more meat as opposed to stomach linings.
Yeah, if you let's think of anatomy a little bit. The swim bladder is attached to the top of the fish, right below the spinal cord.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're gonna miss, you gotta miss way high so you don't go into the spinal cord, or swim bladder's inflated. It's probably less likely that you can get the intestines in. The issue with barotrauma is it pushes everything down so much. But yeah, if you're not, I would rather you miss a little high. I agree with you. Muscle tissue is better than any organ. And that's basically why it's not, recommended to go through the mouth anymore. Is we just recognize that it's really hard to go through the mouth and not go through some other organ to get to the swim bladder.
Yeah.
And all that anatomy changes with every individual with how that swim bladder inflates. So. That's good. Side fizzing that's a good deal. There's a lot of kits available online now to where there's no reason, especially for a guide, that you don't have 5 or 6 kits on the boat ready to go.
Yeah. I'm to a point too, like I don't even like using the same needle on multiple fish. I tried to use like 1 to 2 needles most through the day because you'll go through them fast. And with, there's a lot of other issues in the world. It's kind of hard to get the right size needle because you can get too big or too small.
Right.
So do you have any like proper tips to maybe like, I don't know if we covered this before, I feel like we did, but maybe somehow to like sanitize it if you could for people to use them longer? Probably shouldn't do that, but.
Yeah, so here's the deal, Andy. You've got a needle, and every time you penetrate that fish, you're dulling that needle. It's just like a hook, right? It dulls every time. You also are going to get the potential to have some of the muscle tissue accumulate within the needle itself. So you want to clean the needle out after every use. You want to try to keep a sharp needle so that you can, be efficient with your fizzing. If you're going to clean them, there's no way to sterilize them. Not on a boat. That's not a sterile environment, and there's no really great way to do it. You could try heat, but then you're affecting the actual needle itself because you could be thinning the metal. You can use alcohol, but it's not going to sterilize, and it needs to dry completely before you reinsert it into a fish. So those are still good practice. I would rather see you use alcohol or hydrogen peroxide and let it dry and just have multiple needles that you're rotating through. Of course, in a perfect world, you use a brand new needle every time. But like you said, that becomes difficult, especially, you've been in that situation where you fizz a fish, it looks like it's going to be upright, you put it in live oil, you spend 2 or 3 minutes, you go back to it, and she's on her side again. And you're like, I got to redo that same fish. Like, it becomes frustrating. Clipping, using clips to hold them down works if you're going to release the fish. In a lot of saltwater research, they've just found that lowering them down in cages helps a lot because you can lower them down to the depth they came from and then release them. And that's like the very best way to do it. But once they've already seen that inflation, you got to get the air out. So what you're doing is working, Andy. That's exactly how we recommend all of our MLF pros and our release boat teams use several techniques, but they do a really good job. But that there's some stubborn ones, man.
Yeah, it makes me mad when I fizz them, 'cause like I know the worst thing you can do is not fizz them, but also there's
Right.
a point where you fizz them too much and take too
All
much
of
air out of them, and all of a sudden you pull the needle out and they're like laying on the bottom of your live well on their side, which is
Right.
what you don't. So is there a general tip that you can give to people who are fizzing largemouth, smallmouth, or even spotted bass, like when the proper time would be to pull the needle out so they stay upright?
That's a tough one. I feel like that is a skill best learned,
With
through
time, yeah.
repetition. Because it's hard, you want where you see whenever you put the needle in, you lower the fish, you see a rapid release of bubbles. And then those bubbles are going to slow down. You don't want those bubbles to ever stop. And you really want those bubbles to still be coming out, not at a fast pace, but at a moderate pace, and then pull the needle. If it was me though, and I was trying to like teach somebody for the first time how to do it, I would have them insert the needle with set the fish on in the water, start watching the bubbles, and allow that fish hands. Sorry about that. Allow my fish that fish to be buoyant between my hands and let it maintain itself upright, then pull that needle. And if you have to do it multiple times, I would rather see you do that than deflate that fish completely.
Yeah, what I find is like I'll stick the needle in them outside of the live well and then instantly place them in with the needle because I want to hear the air come out. You'll hear it pop. And then when I put them in, I literally hold them upright. And what I look for is the timing of the bubble. So as soon as it like starts to really start to slow down, that's
Right.
when I'll let the
That's when
fish
you
like
pull.
pull itself. So I'll hold the, because I use Barb Elliott's kit, if for you know who Barb Elliott is, but
Oh
some
yeah,
people here might
that's a
not.
great
Yeah.
kit.
So what I'll do is I'll hold the tag end where you can clean the needle with, and as soon as they shake and go to swim away, I'll just pull it out so they can swim off when they're ready. But
Maybe we need you to do a video.
yeah, maybe we should.
There
Maybe
you
me and
go.
Bailey can do one.
Yeah,
We can
do a
for sure make
video,
that,
Andy.
because we need like six hands to make that happen. So
But that's a skill people need to know, especially let's talk about high school and college anglers. Like that is a skill you need to know, because that's going to help with your fish care ability. I mean, I guess you could say you don't want a lot of people out fizzing fish, but let's be honest. If there are fish floating behind a guide, like that guide needs to know how to do it. If there's fish floating after a weigh-in, like that release boat team needs to know how to do it. So it's a skill we all need.
Yeah, that's one. Actually, I literally just messaged tournament directors for the event I'm fishing this weekend. Even though we're fishing out of kayaks and it's catch and release, sometimes, I mean, I've seen guys that have a fish even up in the net or on the board for a minute or two. That's enough where you're going to need to fizz that fish. So sent them a message of like, hey, it might be smart at least for the guys to be thinking about getting fizz needles if they don't have them this weekend, if they've never been up that way.
And I think
Provide
there's a
them.
big. Go ahead, Stephen. I apologize.
No, I was just gonna say tournament directors can provide them. There is, most of the research papers show 5 minutes to be that big threshold. But here's the hard part. It's the fish above the atmospheric pressure for 5 minutes. So if you catch the fish, you work it to the boat. The time it leaves that first atmospheric pressure, which is usually at 30 foot, and starts to come up, that starts that clock. And then you guys get a length on the fish, you take a couple pictures, you release it, and that fish doesn't go straight back down, then a minute later, it pops up behind the kayak. That could be an issue.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's all dependent on how people fight the fish. Me personally, Bailey can attest to this. I'm one of the people that I want that fish in the boat as fast as possible, no matter how light the line is, because I feel like smallmouth, when you really like, one, if you tire them out to exhaustion while you're fighting them, one, they're going to have more anxiety and stress when you do put them in the live well. They're going to be harder to release promptly when you're putting them back in. Because I found I had a client a couple weeks ago that fought like a 4.5 pounder for seemed like 8 minutes. And I'm not saying it was the wrong thing to do because we got the fish in the boat. But immediately upon putting that fish back in the water, I had to net it and fizz it because of the fact that it took so long to get that fish in the net. So as to where I personally, I'm like, I want to get it up, get it in the boat, because that gives it more time in a tournament setting to acclimate and settle in that live well. So when I go to visit, it's a little calmer and it's not already belly up and half in the waste bucket. So yeah, just my personal take on things. I think if it all depends on the person who's fighting it and how long it takes for them to take the photo, et cetera.
Your guide client for this week is saying so he can keep smallmouth for a catch and cook.
There you go.
I mean,
why is that? Just kidding. No. You're not allowed to keep any smallmouth?
Not really. I probably should, but like if we gut hook one and it doesn't go back down and it has no chances, I'll take it home. But usually it's walleye that we end up keeping if we get any.
And they taste way better.
Yeah, way better.
Come on, guys. There's nothing wrong with it.
I know. I'm not against it. Like, if people want to eat them, go ahead and eat them. But I tend not to keep bass. So.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Let those fat suckers go back down there.
Make big babies.
That's not how it works.
I know. I know it's not.
We're stuck in our ways, Steve, right? So on this conversation, I was thinking back to the guy who taught me a lot about fish care, especially we're talking about smallmouth and deep water. His name's Dean Meckes, who's a guide up actually on the St. Lawrence River. And one thing that was super cool that he taught me, and this is going to lead into a question that we have here from a viewer, was talking about ice and not like using bagged ice, because sometimes you put too much, it can, you know, get too cold too quick and shock fish and all that. And how he used like these sherbet cans, and he had like this bigger thing of ice that he'd separate with pool noodles so that it would, you know, that ice would melt slower. Therefore, it's a gradual, you know, decrease in temperature, that sort of thing. You get where I'm leading to. So that's where I started to learn about this stuff. So we have a question here from Nonstop Panic Outdoors asking, is there such a thing as making the water too cold for smallmouth with ice?
Absolutely. And I'll plug myself for a second. I've got a really great article on majorleaguefishing.com about how to ice your fish, like the process. I even have like a calculator that I built that talks about how many pounds you can safely put into your live well. Because here's the issue. You don't want to ever ice your fish so rapid that you drop the temperature on them and put them into a cold shock. And there's not, I could not find a calculator online at all for like how much ice do I want to put in and like what is it going to do to my temperature. So that's what I did. I just built one. So it's on majorleaguefishing.com. You go to the fisheries management site. It's the second article up on the thing right now. Basically, kind of the moral of the story is you want to, once you have five fish in your live well, you want to keep that temperature 5 degrees below what the water temperature is and no more. If you start dropping it 7 to 10 degrees, that's fine, but it needs to be over a long, it needs to be over like all day long I'm doing that. So if I catch my fish the first hour of the day and I want to start icing them, I want to drop them 5 degrees and I want to maintain them at that or below, but then I'm not really trying to cold fish throughout the day. Like, that's my bag. If you take a fish that you just caught, you drop it 10 15 degrees it's immediately going to go into cold shock, and then you can have a dead fish on your hands. And once you have one dead fish in your live well, that really taints the whole thing, because the ammonia is going to build up quick. So that's the hard part about icing. You know, you do it too rapid, and you will kill fish. But 5 degrees is the big number. What Bailey's talking about is using something that dissolves slower than ice. By freezing a bottle of water or something like that, that has a smaller amount of surface area, then that's going to thaw slower. And so it's naturally going to hold that temperature better for you, Bailey, throughout the day. So instead of just rapidly dropping in, Gary Klein told me a story about Aaron Martin's one time, that Aaron pulled up to the dump, had two big bags of ice, dumped them in on his fish. 5 minutes later, the fish were dead. And he's like, "Bro, I don't know what happened, bro." And kept, you know, asking Gary. And Gary's like, "You put too much ice in too quick and like killed them off." So if you don't have the big water bottles, you don't do it that way. The other option is to carry ice with you and just add. That calculator I built basically does is it tells you how much ice to add to drop it, the temperature you need to drop it.
So where is that calculator again?
Let's see, majorleaguefishing.com. You can go to the fisheries management division. There's a main hot button on the main page on your right, about halfway down. That's fisheries management division logo. Or you can click the three dots to get to the more, and then that fisheries management division page will pop up.
All right, I'm at the fisheries. Man, let me actually share a screen here, and you can.
Let's
I
see
think
it.
this would be
Yeah,
good.
let's see
I
it.
want to link this for people,
It'd be
because I
great.
think this is a really good tool to have. And I actually didn't realize it existed. So this is awesome.
Okay, so there's the that's an awesome video. Kevin and Dan fishing one of our habitat projects. Scroll down.
Okay.
That second article right there, Michael Neal, Ice and Fish. That's going to be the icing
Right here.
fish article. Yeah.
Okay.
There you go. And it's got kind of I walk through what icing does to the fish, what the benefits are. I interviewed several of our anglers. I got their tips on how they like to do it, and then I went ahead and gave you kind of the science. And here's the calculators. There's you. It's a little bit of a read, not too bad. And there's the chart that I built. So based on your live well size, how much do you want to drop it? There's even the formula up there if you really want it. But that gets extremely technical.
That's pretty
That's
damn
how many
cool.
pounds of ice. Yeah, and there. I mean, you. Technically, if you're putting a large amount of ice in your live well, you could worry about the chlorine that is frozen within that ice, but it's not really that big of an issue. The issue is the rapid decrease in temperature. But we use ice, you know, when we're hauling fish, you know, we're hauling hundreds of pounds of fish, and the things we do is we salt the water. That is all freshwater fish are always looking for salt, and salt helps them produce their slime layer, which is a great immune suppressing tool. So we salt the water. We use pure dissolved oxygen at a low rate. We try to keep it up, you know, under 10. We don't try to put a lot of oxygen because you can burn their gills with dissolved oxygen. And then we add ice, and we use that same kind of formula. And we'll
Got
haul 200 pounds of fish and 100 gallons of water, and they'll live all day long like that. You guys are hauling, you know, hopefully, let's say 25 pounds and 40 gallons of water, but that's, you know, that's a lot of pounds.
So correct me if I'm wrong here, and I've heard this from several people, but they're saying that like when you put fish in live well, the most important part then ice and all that jazz is the recirculation of new water. Is that the
Correct.
most important aspect of putting fish in your live well?
Yeah, because the recirculation brings in new oxygen, and it takes out ammonia and carbon dioxide that builds up in the live well. So the live well's contained system of about 40 gallons of water, and 40 gallons of water should hold, you know, in something that doesn't have pure oxygen being brought into it. 40 gallons of water should hold about 4 pounds of fish. That's what the water's gonna do. So you start increasing the pounds beyond 4 pounds, and you're stressing that system. And so what you've got to do is bring in new water, or you got to make that water within the live well have more dissolved oxygen to keep those fish alive. So that's why almost any time if I was competing, I would have the recirculating pump on. The only time I wouldn't is, let's say I'm competing in Texas right now and I'm, you know, on a hydrilla flat or something like that, where the water becomes very shallow. And that intake pump is taking in surface water on top of vegetation, because that's going to have an increased temperature and it's going to have a lot of organic matter. And so what I might do in that is run my recirculating pump, not my intake pump, and then pop out into main lake and add water periodically. But it has to be like every 10 to 15 minutes, and nobody's going to do that. You know, if you read the icing article, Edwin has Edwin talks about monitoring temperature in his lab wells. At that same time, he was also monitoring dissolved oxygen. He had a system to do it. And if I was like a boat manufacturer and I was trying to build the perfect live well, there would be some monitoring parameters in there, right? Like I would know what the temperature was in the live well, and I would know what the dissolved well is. And if it fell below a certain range or got out of, you know, whatever range I said, I, you know, it would have some sort of alarm, you know, and I would be able to make a correction, you know.
Or an automatic system that would pump in fresh water. Right.
Automatic fresh water, you know, the there are some oxygenators that are available, and there's also people that do carry pure, you know, O2 in tanks, and through regulators pump O2 into their live wells. Anytime you're putting oxygen in the live well, you're going to be able to support more pounds of fish. But you can go, like I said, you can actually go too high on that, because oxygen in its pure form will burn the gills. And by burn, I mean like deteriorate the cellular structure of the gill and cause the fish to not be able to absorb oxygen because it gets too much. But that takes some time. It takes a lot of oxygen to do that.
Makes sense. Andy, you got anything for Steve?
No, we actually did have a viewer question, I think, on the Instagram about call tags and why smallmouth have a more increased mortality rate. It seems like with punctureless call tags as opposed to puncturing call tags. Do you have any idea on that?
I've done zero research on this. It would be a complete guess at this point for me to tell you why they would have any kind of change in mortality. I mean, you know, puncturing the membrane of the mouth, especially the bottom membrane, affects the suction feeding ability of a fish. So how almost all fish work is when their mouth is closed, they have a very small area within their mouth. And when they open their mouth, because their gills flare, it creates a opening that has a negative space to it. And so that negative space sucks water in really rapidly. But if you had any part of that mouth besides the gills flaring, you had a puncture to it, a large opening, the water is going to escape through that hole, or that suction can escape through the hole. So it's going to affect their ability to feed. So I could definitely understand why puncturing tags are no longer used. Like that makes complete sense. But to say that they have a lower mortality rate, immediate mortality rate, than a non-puncturing tag on smallmouth would be, it's out of my area of expertise there.
Yeah, I personally don't even like call tagging smallmouth, because I found like no matter what you do with call tags and smallies, one of them always dies. And then if you have one die, then automatically it seems like you have a catastrophic event happen in your live well and they all start dying. And that's because of the ammonia release, but I just hate seeing them dead. I'd rather take my time grabbing the small one and get 40 combat wounds from dorsal fins than have a dead smallmouth floating in my live well. So
yeah, there's
what
been
happened, what happens to them, Andy? Yeah, what
so when you like, I've seen it happen like in tournaments where I have a small one, I throw a punctureless call tag, because I've used both puncture ones and non-puncture, right? And I know, like, you're not supposed to pop the membrane in the bottom. You almost, like, pierce the lip with the puncturing one so you don't tear the bottom of the mouth. But what I found was with the non-puncturing one is they almost go, like, spasm mode because there's so much pressure on their lower lip that they'll start almost freaking out. You can hear when you put that call tag on them in the live wall, they'll just spaz for, like, minutes at a time sometimes. And I'll just go right back in there, and you'll see, like, if you have a non-puncturing one in there, their eyes will start to get, like, that marble orange. They'll stress right out, and then as soon as you pull it off, they'll be, like, fine.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. I've been in the boat with several smallmouth gurus from, you know, DMX, like I mentioned earlier, to Andy, to Buddy Casey Smith, to Chris Johnson, and none of them used the call tags, or even honestly the fin clips.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A lot of guys won't even use those. They're like, they just leave them be. And it's an interesting thing. It's like these small mouth are just so gosh darn sensitive.
No, I mean, I don't, if I'm competing in a tournament, I don't use a call tag either, but I'm with Andy. Right. Like I handle fish all day long. So I'm like, good luck.
Hands are numb at that point.
Like I'm pretty sure I have like, I'm going to count right now. 1, 2, 3. I have at least 8 or 9 like holes in my hand from dorsal fins, just grabbing fish. Cause I just come like right behind their head and squeeze them and pull them out. And they're mean to me.
Yeah. So here's a question I'm very curious about. And I've seen a lot of people talking about when the event was there. I had an event there 2 weeks after Major League Fishing at Cayuga Lake. And you might have even been brought it up to or have seen the guys talking about it on live with the blind largemouth. I don't know if you know what I'm referring to. But we had a big event there, 100-plus anglers, a couple weeks later, and a lot of people are catching blind largemouth.
Right.
What do you think the leading reason? I have my own personal theories, but they're more petty than anything else as to what might be happening. But what do you think, in all actuality, might be the reason why that's happening?
Yeah. Well, the only frame of reference I have, because I wasn't at the Cayuga event, I watched some of it, but and I was asked this question. Periodically, we get questions submitted on the website, and you know, anything science related comes to me. And so I had a short conference call with several people that were interested in this topic in the Cayuga community. But the only frame of reference I really have is what we see in private lake management. And in private lake management, we have two primary causes whenever we see fish that have eye injuries, or like an abundance of blind fish. And the first one is parasites. There are these type of nematodes that are basically like a flatworm. I don't remember if you guys remember dissecting flatworms. Like
we're talking about the Maxant kind?
Yeah, the flatworms, yeah. I'm not blaming for fishing, I promise. No. There's a type of nematode that it's, you know, its common name is a white grub, but they live within the eye of fish. Shad species, LY species, they're going to live in the eye. And what they do is they migrate through the body, they get in the eye, and then they're living in the eye, and they migrate to the top of the eye and try to shade the eye to where the fish thinks that it's deeper than it actually is and will swim up and let like a bird or a predator eat it. And that's how it continues its life cycle. These worms are crazy. But periodically,
so sadistic.
We get them so dense sometimes in private fisheries that you'll see a majority of, especially the larger largemouth, will start losing their eyes as well. And it seems like that parasite, when it migrates, that fish is consumed by a largemouth, and it always is the larger largemouth that consume them, that parasite migrates to the eye and denucleates the eye or makes it flat. That's the first cause that I see in private lakes. The second cause, whenever we get a lot of angling pressure. We get a lot of angling pressure on a private lake. you can have fish lose their eyes. So it's those two causes that are common in private lakes. Some of the other reasons that I heard proposed, there's just no good scientific evidence to support some of the other things that I was hearing being thrown around as causes for blind fish at Cayuga.
That's probably the reason too that I'm blaming it for too, is probably the biggest.
Definitely thing the reason you're blaming, and there's just no scientific evidence there. Yeah.
Yeah, makes sense. Somebody talked me down off my ledge.
Yeah, there's a lot of things. There's a lot of things going wrong. You know, at Cayuga, just like in a lot of reservoirs, and most of them are way more complicated than we want them to be.
Yeah, it seems like there's a few lakes that are very identical in New York to what is happening at Cayuga. It is crazy to see the difference of that lake 5 years ago to now.
Right.
Even from like a vegetation standpoint, I mean, there was some decent, you know, healthy milfoil and such when I was there in June. But like, I mean, it used to be fields of it years ago.
Absolutely.
It's interesting to see that people are thinking that the smallmouth emerged more or are becoming stronger every year. But I personally think they've always been there, but this lack of grass each year is allowing them to expand where they have, like, where they inhabit. I think that's why we're seeing them in places we've never seen them before.
Well, and your technologies have increased to where
true
you can go catch them. You know, it's 20 years ago, it would have been impossible for you to go out in 80 foot of water and find smallmouth, right? Just roaming. You wouldn't have done it. Now that isn't impossible.
Now it's a common thing.
It's like, why wouldn't I be doing that? Why wouldn't I be out here in the middle of the abyss catching smallmouth and just spinning 30 foot of water? Pounds
hair jig just slow rolling out. Like, what?
I mean, when we had Keith Carson on, he was saying he was on Champlain and he was throwing at 120 foot of water and he was just reeling a drop shot like 20 feet under the surface and catching them. It's like,
why wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's just it's craziness. This is why we have you on, Steve, because otherwise my theories and my brain would be running wild and I'd be blaming the wrong things. So
no, I mean, I've always made it very well known that, you know, I spray a lot of vegetation. You know, my private company, we do a lot. We even contract and do things on state reservoirs, but we do it with an ethics that I'm a bass fisherman. And I think that especially largemouth, every research shows that aquatic vegetation is essential for largemouth. You know, you can have other types of habitat that make largemouth populations possible, but they thrive near aquatic vegetation. So, you know, I'm very supportive of that. I'm very supportive that there are species of plants that don't come from the United States that are beneficial to some environments, you know, that we like to fish. And a lot of those environments, if we're being 100% transparent, are reservoirs that aren't natural systems anyways. So they weren't part of the United States either. You know, so we can talk semantics all we want.
You have invasive lakes.
Lakes. I love it.
I mean, we can carve it up how we want. I think, you know, if we look at fisheries management, we have challenges that may be discussing which species is native versus non-native is not the right approach. Our challenges come from the fact that we built reservoirs in the 50s and 60s at a very high rate. And now those reservoirs have aged to the point where they have deteriorating water quality. They have increased silt loads. They have populations of fish that are skewed because we don't consume fish. In some areas, it's not safe to consume fish because of metals and things like that are within them. We have those challenges. Those challenges are much greater than worrying about if a species of plant is native or non-native.
Yeah.
And wouldn't, like, if you had grass in those lakes, I mean, I could be wrong here, but you know how like trees will suck up like carbon dioxide? Wouldn't technically like aquatic vegetation kind of like help filtrate like be a filtration system for some of these heavy metals and maybe even help filter out some of the chemicals and harsh stuff that's floating around?
Man, that's a loaded question of I don't mean to mean to you, Andy, but that's, there's a lot of inaccuracy with it, like in that question. So I'm gonna.
I figured there would. That's why I had to ask. So
because there's no straight answer to that one. So plants absorb nutrients, right? Mainly nitrate, nitrogen, nitrite, nitrogen, or phosphorus in the form of phosphate. Like that's what they're pulling out of the water. There's some potassium and things like that as well. So yes, if we talk about like. Why do we see blue-green algae blooms in Okeechobee? It's because we don't have plants absorbing the phosphorus. Like that is on a simple level, like that makes sense. Plants also release nutrient every time they die. And so like one of the biggest arguments against hydrilla is the fact that because it's a non-native species, it isn't used to our temperature and our temperate environments. So like we've got a lake about 45 miles north of me that had hydrilla in it. And Texas Parks and Wildlife stance on hydrilla is, if it is in an environment and is not harming humans or navigation, we should leave it for fish habitat. Like we're not going to like do a lot of control on it. Now we do some to improve like access to your docks and things like that, but it's all a contact herbicide or in small areas. But hydrilla cannot handle high, cold, turbid water. And 2 winters ago, we had high, cold, turbid water, and it killed all the hydrilla out of the entire reservoir. 40,000 acres of reservoirs now clean of hydrilla. That's even worse for that environment, because what you had was a healthy hydrilla population that died off overnight. And now it's all dead, and it's not coming back. And so those fish that were living in that environment, they lost their habitat overnight. Native plants typically, and Andy, I'm trying to get to the answer to your question here, but native plants typically are more hardy. They can survive our winters. They can survive hard water. They can survive turbidity. They rebound quickly. So that's why you see so many biologists that are like, okay, guys, we got to control hydrilla or in some places milfoil, and we got to replace it with a native plant. Because on paper, that does make sense. That makes sense because it's going to give us something that's sustainable. The problem with an aging reservoir is those plants still tend to accumulate silt, and then they cycle every year to where you're going to have that biomass of plant that dies and becomes silt. So you are, the second that a reservoir is impounded with a dam, you can start a clock. And that clock, what it's doing is it's counting down to where that reservoir becomes land again. And that's the process that's happening. Every reservoir we have is turning back into land. Now, how long does that take? Depends on the watershed, depends on the types of vegetation and their cycle, depends on the amount of silt accumulating in the original depth of that reservoir. Some reservoirs, it's going to take 200, 300 years. Other reservoirs, you're seeing fill it in very quickly. And, you know, in another 25, 30 years, you don't have fishable water. That happens in reservoir systems. Now, you guys, you know, you're fishing glacial systems. You're fishing things that are natural. They're not silting in. Their accumulation of sediment is very slow. But a native or a invasive or non-native plant is increasing that silt load, is increasing that nutrient load. So, Andy, to answer your question, like, yes, there are plants to target very specific problems within a reservoir or a natural water body. But they would need to be very selected. No plant is going to pull metals out of water or improve like some sort of contamination process. Like that's completely on the other side of water quality. But nutrient loads, definitely plants can take care of.
Yeah, and I never even heard that. It was just a question. Something I don't
know. I love you, man. I love your crazy questions.
Yeah, it's good. So, but now I do have another crazy question for you. So, like, say Cayuga Lake, they love to carpet bomb it, spray it, pellet drop it, right? And do eliminate certain types of vegetation, even though they eliminate all the vegetation. If the scientists are saying, like, we need to eliminate this invasive vegetation and keep the natural stuff. Wouldn't you think that they'd come up with a solution to like even just replant some of the natural stuff? Because all it takes really is like a millifant, a microfiber of a plant for it to hit the water, and in cases of most aquatic vegetation for it to sprout, right? Or is it just certain types of grass?
This is a really good question, Andy. So herbicides have different modes of action. And over the past 40 years, herbicides have been developed to target very specific plants. There are literally herbicides on the market right now that target non-native plants and leave native plants. There are also herbicides that you and I vote, and I can draw your name in a weed map. And in 3 weeks, your name is still there, and the plants all the way around your name are just fine. So there's ways to do it. They're either more expensive or really time consuming, but there's ways to do it. And take the plants you don't want and leave the plants you do. That is possible. The issue with repopulating a native aquatic plant or a plant that you want is you've got too many herbivores. And primarily in our systems, it's common carp. That's the biggest issue, because common carp will uproot just about any plant whenever it's real soft and they're trying to establish. And common carp are a non-native species as well. Common carp are not native to the United States. So
yeah, they're European, right?
Yeah, they come from Europe in the 1800s. U.S. Fish and Wildlife brought them to us. But common carp are one big issue. Turtles can be a big issue. So what you're talking about is the process, what we call fragmentation, where you could take an aquatic plant, you could put it in some sort of container, and as pieces of it break off and it floats throughout a bay or into an area, what we could have is plants propagate from that. And that does work. And you're seeing states like Arkansas, a little bit in Texas, a little bit in Louisiana, you're seeing that being tried. And not to let the cat out of the bag, but I think you will see the Bass Pro Tour try that next year.
Hmm. Very intriguing.
So, yes, we might do something like that.
I like it. Andy, you got anything else for Steve?
Oh, I'm good for round three. I look forward to round four.
Oh, man, that was quick. Do we have any fans? I mean, do we have anybody, any questions that we didn't answer?
We don't have any fans. There's nobody that's listening to this right now.
Oh, we actually do have a good question from Hunter here. He says he's a biology student at Ohio State and on their bass team, but in regards to the project with KVD, what's the benefit of putting in the man-made brush piles into the lake for habitat versus real brush from fallen trees?
You haven't gotten this question at all, have you?
No. I love this question. This is one of my favorites. First, Hunter, keep going, man. We need plenty of biologists that also fish bass tournaments. We need that. If you're not a member of American Fisheries Society, we have a meeting in Michigan later this month where we're going to talk about citizen science and how anglers and biologists can work together on really cool research projects. And we need people like Hunter that are both citizen and scientist. We need that. So the question is, why do we on the Bass Pro Tour or any of my habitat projects use artificial habitat over real brush? And there's several compounding factors there. Number one, most of our reservoirs were built with real brush or standing timber. And what you've seen is over 30 or 40 years, the timber has degraded. It's created silt. You see that whenever we take brush off of a shoreline or even Christmas trees, things that we're trying to recycle, and we bring those to a reservoir, that they are short-lived, 2 to 5 years, depending on the species. And you see a lot of times that as that brush degrades, it creates a bigger issue. It creates a water quality issue around it. So whenever we partnered with a company called Mossback Fish Habitat. They make their product out of recycled PVC. So not like plastic bottles, that's a polyurethane. more like the PVC pipe that maybe your plumbing is made out of in your house. They take that PVC and they recycle it into a tube and then limbs. And then they have different configurations of how you put those together. The limbs are textured and they have a V shape to them. So it becomes very hard for an angler to actually like pin a hook on them. The V shape allows the hook to ride up the limb. But the limb accumulates what we would call periphyton, which is a micro community of bacteria and algae and planktons and invertebrates, and they live in those limbs. And so what happens is that periphyton creates a small community that feeds a lot of juvenile fish, minnow species, shad species, things like that, even things like detritivores like crawfish. And so that becomes a community that attracts more fish. And as we work our way up the food chain, it allows us to have a greater biomass of fish living off of that one structure. So kind of the question is for us that we were trying to answer is, do we want to put habitat in that we know we're going to have to replenish, and we're going to have to do that on a periodic cycle that may or may not be creating silt and some water quality issues? Or do we want to try to come up with a solution that is a one-time, you know, PVC doesn't have a known degradation time in water. The only way that PVC could degrade is if it was hit by something and mechanically broken down. There's really not a mechanism for that in reservoirs or natural water bodies. So unless we put it super shallow and like somebody's hitting it with their boat, which we absolutely do not do, we have these really safe habitat zones that are going to last a lifetime. Those artificial habitats will actually be buried in silt long before they will ever degrade. And so, that is the hard part for us, is trying to make sure that whenever we're putting them in, we're putting them in hard bottom areas or areas that, we can float them up a little bit. So hopefully that answers the question, Hunter. Definitely want to see you sometime at a fisheries meeting or something. Would love to hear your opinion on it, because this is still part of science that's evolving. That's the best part of fishery science, is we built these reservoirs. We had no idea what we were doing with fisheries management when those reservoirs were built. They put regulations in to try to stop people from consuming too many fish. It worked way too well. And now people don't consume fish and the reservoirs are aging, and we live in like the golden age of fisheries management, where we have new technologies available. We're learning our lessons from the past, and we're probably making a few mistakes. So hopefully artificial habitat is not part of that. I know that like some in the history of reservoir management, like some people try to use tires, and tires turned out to be a really bad idea. But all the research shows artificial habitat using like the PVC is a really good management practice.
That's super intriguing.
No, I mean, I love it. We use mossback habitat. We use three things on reservoirs that I build for my clients. We use mossback, we use rock, and we use a lot of rock. And then we use aquatic plants. And we've got like a list of about five or six species of aquatic plants that we use. And we intermingle those three things together to cover everything from erosion control of the dam to ambush habitat for largemouth to great crawfish habitat, forage habitat for like your juvenile fish to live around, nursery habitat for fry to, grow and continue their survival, spawning habitat for third fin shad. Like, we can cover it all with rock, aquatic plants, and the artificial habitat.
Nonstop Panic has a great comment here. Said, now if only New York would allow us to put these artificial structures in the lakes.
Well, don't worry, guys.
You hear that, New York?
I've had those arguments. And I would tell everybody, research is still like any question somebody has about artificial habitat, research is being done to try to address that question, right or wrong. And that's, if you're a really good scientist, you're not trying to prove anything. You're trying to disprove everything. So we see that research is being done to show What are the sources of microplastics? That's something we should all be concerned about, is microplastics. We show that people are looking into, is the PVC of today truly as stable of a compound as it was, or is it more stable a compound than it was back in the 50s, 60s, 70s? Because some of that old PVC, man, that was leaching chemical, but they've changed the compound to the point where it's very stable. I know that, like, our personal house, I've made this comment before, like, people are like, you wouldn't put that in your drinking water. I'm like, dude, my house has PVC that brings the water to my house. I drink out of PVC every single day, because that's how our water is supplied. Like, it is apparently a much safer product now than it was, 30 years ago. And there's research every single day that's looking into that. Actually, in the EU, there's only one plastic that's allowed to be used in your body, and it's PVC. They can make like parts of your heart and circulatory system out of PVC. I'm like,
What?
that's crazy, right? Crazy.
Yes, so
That is intriguing.
if you can have PVC installed in the human body, it's probably okay to be installed in a lake on a controlled basis.
Exactly. On a controlled basis. That's a good point there too, Andy. It's not, you got to really worry about, navigation. You want to make sure that wherever you install artificial habitat, that it's safe. You also need to think about function. If I just go throw them out in 120 foot, like, how many fish are going to use them? Like, we have to do it in a way that makes sense. Like, our process always involves the lake authority, whoever the managing agency is, because those are two different things. Your managing agency and your lake authority are not the same people. They both make decisions in different areas. We involve both of them. We involve our anglers, because we want to make sure that, like, we, in my opinion, we have the best 80 anglers in the world. Like, why can't I use them to help me figure out where to put habitat? Like, that just makes sense. And then, of course, we do it, Bailey knows, we do it with corporate sponsorship, corporate help from groups that really want to improve fisheries. They want to take their profit margin and put it back into making our reservoirs better. And when we have science, anglers, and corporations working together, like, we can do a lot.
Yeah. That is the one refreshing thing I will say about all of this, is that there are a lot of very smart, way smarter than Andy and I, people like yourself that are investing this time and money to better our fisheries. But yeah, there's more comments of imagine how many people would dump artificial habitat day one after New York says it's okay to do so. He said the
That's right.
more people will be at the ramp than opening night for walleye fishing. That's very true.
Yeah, everybody, and then, like,
Although we
we.
can homeowners can put in weed mats, which is very, it confuses me.
So New York State is, there's a law in the books that basically says that you cannot alter the bottom of like a natural lake, right? But yet we have Finger Lakes where homeowners can legally slash illegally install basically carpet mats with cinder blocks to hold them down to kill off aquatic vegetation around their docks. And I don't even know what the material is that they put in. It's like a synthetic tarp material. So I'm
Yeah,
sure that's
that's
great
it.
for the water quality.
Well, it's not good for my baits with treble hooks. Want my baits back, Steve.
I agree with that. Can they use like lake rollers, like the rollers that roll on the bottom?
I don't even know if we're allowed to do that. We're like the rule is, I do believe that we are not allowed to modify the bottom composition of our lakes, period.
It's very interesting. Can you put bubblers, like aeration, like compressed air?
I've seen marinas with that, but I've never really seen them around docks.
Yeah, I've seen a couple
that's
docks that have
interesting.
them in the wintertime.
Yeah, I would. Mean, there's a lot of solutions to aquatic plants. Aquatic plants don't like a ton of water movement. Aquatic plants don't like constant, movement over the top of them. Like, there's plants that don't involve a lot of things, but yeah, I mean, there will be solutions that come available, guys.
There's
That's
one
the
thing
best.
I am in touch with with the DEC trying to figure out is why can't we put stuff in our lakes, but the homeowners can. That's the one problem New York still has is when the anglers don't really have a seat or any voice.
Because you're trying to talk to the DEC. The DEC is your fisheries resource agency. They're not necessarily the lake authority. They don't own the lake. Hmm. So whoever the lake authority is would make the decision of what you can put in it.
Hmm.
Like whenever we do a habitat project, let me think of one for real. Let's say we were going to do, we did the one in at Duck River Reservoir, right? Duck River, that's the one that Kevin did the video on. It's well worth the watch. We did that 2 years ago. And Duck River Reservoir is owned by the city of Coleman, Alabama. So originally I had called Alabama DNR and asked them if we could collaborate on a project. And they were just busy. You know, they just had too many things on their schedule. And so they're like, we can't, and we don't have an existing permit to do any projects. So we called Mayor Jacobs at the city of Coleman, Alabama, and asked him if any of his reservoirs could be approved. And so they just simply called the water board together. They held one vote that approved our permit. We were ready to put in whatever we wanted, wherever we wanted. That's how it works. Like there's a water authority that controls the water within the reservoir or within, you know, the water body. Now, New York Department of Conservation may have a seat on that water board, but they're not the decision maker.
Hmm. Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah, you start looking at your statutes and you realize there's when we were at Lake Norman, and for Red Crest, like that is owned by Duke Energy. Duke Energy makes the decisions. There are two water authorities that purchase water to supply to local places, right? Like Charlotte or wherever. They make the decision on like these two water controlling boards, and Duke Energy made the decision to stock grass carp to remove hydrilla in Lake Norman. And the DNR wasn't even in the vote. Like they don't even get an opinion on it. And now the grass carp are in the lake to control the hydrilla. The DNR has
That's just vote. Crazy to me.
Well, it just depends on who owns the reservoir, who owns the water.
Yeah.
Your fisheries agency is tasked by your state Congress and you know, your state Senate to manage the resource, but they don't own the resource.
Hmm. Gosh.
Quit giving them such a hard time, Bailey.
I know. I'm going to keep giving them a hard time. Oh, man. Steve, you're awesome, man. We always appreciate you taking the time out and come on and answer all these questions that me and Andy cannot answer.
Of course, guys. No, I love it. Thank you all for the invite.
Always.
Sorry I was on two screens tonight, but
well, we got two there. Steves.
That's a great deal. That's a great deal.
Two for one.
Great screen, Steve, and Steve in the flesh. Nice.
Yeah, we got good audio. I was happy. Seriously, if you guys have any more questions, just tell Andy and Bailey to have me back. I'd love to join the show again.
Heck yeah.
Always
you already know, pleasure, guys. You already know it's going to happen. But yeah, appreciate it, buddy. We'll talk to you soon.
Talk to y'all soon.
See ya. I got to boot two Steves from the show.
Nice. Get out of here, Steve times two.
Great show, as always, dropping a lot of knowledge on all of us, answering the questions that we'd like answered, that you know, we can have our theories and our inklings as anglers, and things that stir in our mind that, you know, we think are reasons why. But, you know, Steve and his panel of fish biologists and people much smarter than us are able to debunk the wild theories going on in our brains, or the different reasons we think are happening the way they are. They put some truth behind that. So always good, and appreciate y'all for joining in, throwing questions out there. Some great engagement from you guys tonight. Appreciate y'all for that. Andy, what's coming up for you?
Lots and lots of fishing. That's pretty much it. So yeah. It's we're starting to get back into busy season. I do have some openings in September for guide trips, but that's about it. So if you want to get on Catch Some Smallmouth, now is the time. And also, if you want to plan your trip for next year, May and June are almost full. So you do want to get on in on that prime time to catch some giant smallmouth.
Heck yeah. Well, folks, we appreciate all of you guys. We are trying to work to see if we can get a Friday show. Unfortunately, our Friday show fell through for trying to record ahead of time because I'm going to be out of town tomorrow till Friday. But we're going to try to figure something out. Worst case, we might not have an episode for you Friday, but we will bounce back with you guys for next week. Worst case, we'll have Fantasy Fishing Live on Monday night, and we'll have Tuesday Night Live with Matt Steffen, who just won the Invitational on the Mississippi River, talk some hover rig. And then next Friday, we'll have Mr. Jeff Queen from Queen Tackle, also the person driving behind the Master Cup Fishing, the new fishing.
I'm excited to talk about that
this fall. Yeah, so that'll be interesting. But we're trying to get Terrence on for this Friday. He's got a crazy busy schedule. We have crazy busy schedules. We are trying our best here, but we will try our damnedest to get you guys an episode for Friday. But Andy, fun show tonight, folks. Appreciate y'all. You guys are amazing, and we'll see you on the next one.